Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Now, I had said before the break, and I had teased a little bit at the beginning of the program, that we would be talking about Christian ethics in the workplace with Pastor Phil Lacus. Pastor Phil Lacus' wife has taken ill. He needs to take care of her. He won't be available during this hour, so we'll have an hour of open lines for your questions and your comments. In the third hour of the program, Bob Leko joins us. Total Depravity and Original Sin. That sounds like an interesting subject to deal with for an hour with Bob Leko on a Thursday afternoon. Total Depravity and Original Sin. People like to talk about that kind of stuff. We'll talk about it in the third hour of the program today. It's open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. No, not a lot of feel-good theology in the third hour of Issues, etc. This will not be a boost to your self-esteem. I can guarantee you. If you want your boost to your self-esteem, you might have to get it in this hour of open lines. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We spent an hour talking with Scott Klusendorf of Stand to Reason about the Newsweek cover story, The War Over Fetal Rights. This was last week. Ellen Goodman wrote a column, In the Battle Over Fetal Rights, The Mother Remains Neglected. Now, this shouldn't surprise anyone. Don't get all huffy about this. This is Ellen Goodman's normal plan of attack. I want you to consider, however, the irony, the unbelievable irony in this headline, in this title, In Battle Over Fetal Rights, The Mother Remains Neglected. Now, who gets killed when an abortion is performed, when a mother exercises her rights, or her supposed right to choose? Who ends up dead? The fetus. I do not know why she's sounding the alarm, because as far as I can tell, looking out into the world around me, in the battle over fetal rights, the mother is still winning. And you know, the interesting thing is, the only people who are trying to pit the fetus's rights against the mother's rights are those who are asserting the mother's rights over against those of the fetus. Because the pro-life position says, look, we're not arguing against the rights of mothers. We would like them to remain mothers. Isn't it amazing she calls it the mother? I mean, if the fetus is not a human being, not a baby deserving to be protected, why does she refer to the woman who is carrying around this fetus in her womb as a mother? Maybe it's just a Freudian slip. Now, her argument actually comes from this terrible case of a young lady, 22 years old, severely retarded, prone to seizures. The only name that's given for her in the column is the initials JDS. She weighs 88 pounds. She suffers from seizures, autism, and cerebral palsy. She's mentally retarded with the age of an infant. Actually, Goodman is incorrect on that. She has the mental age of a four-year-old. She can't actually communicate. She has been raped, and she's pregnant. Now, you may have been following that story. She got an abortion. She didn't ask for the abortion. She got an abortion. I think her father saw to it that she got it. And Ellen Goodman opines in her column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, this pregnant rape victim needs someone else to make decisions about her health, the health of the fetus, even to collect DNA evidence of the crime. She needs someone else to make the decision, and Ellen Goodman is happy to do it for her. She says she needs an abortion. Decisions about the health of the fetus. That really, I find this incredible, doesn't seem to figure into Ellen Goodman's argument. The health of the fetus is not in question. This fetus is going to die. In fact, sad to say, you read on in the story, that's what she argues for, and that's what happened. The fetus of a rape victim was aborted despite the efforts of activists who took their fight to the Florida Supreme Court, an attorney said. Doctors said a full-term pregnancy would have threatened the life of the mother. This is bone-chilling, if you ask me. In the same week, we've got a nationally syndicated columnist, Ellen Goodman, whining because a mother's rights, and she has the gall to call a woman who wants an abortion against her own argument, the gall to call a woman who wants an abortion a mother, when in fact, by her own arguments, this woman isn't a mother. I mean, mothers have children. And if it's a child in the womb, then Ellen Goodman's got a real problem. And in the same week, these amazing images in Newsweek magazine of the baby at all stages of pregnancy with this new imaging techniques that show the baby in 3D, in real time, and as unmistakably a baby. What was your reaction when you saw the Newsweek story? Or when you read the arguments of those who in the same breath can call a pregnant woman a mother and then say, oh, by the way, that thing in her womb has no rights and doesn't even deserve to be called a child. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I know my reaction when my wife was pregnant and we went into the OBGYN. I remember an unbelievable reaction when, with the old sonogram technology, you know that grainy picture that made the baby look like the coast of West Africa or something like that, as viewed by night from a satellite, and it's moving and it's kind of squirming and you're seeing something. Was that a leg? No, that wasn't a leg. I'm here, you know, Mr. Amateur doctor trying to guess at what I'm seeing, and of course the technician there is saying, when I say, is that a leg? No, that's a rib. Oh. Was that the head? No. That was just a bubble. Oh. So I can't figure out what it is. But I remember the very first sonogram. It wasn't a squirming little child with legs and ribs and a head that I could see. All I could see was a blinking pixel in the center of a black screen. And I could hear through this amazing stethoscope-like device the heartbeat, and it wasn't my wife's heartbeat, it was the baby's heartbeat, and I could hear it in sync with the blinking pixel. And the technician there said, now look, this is all we can really get an image of, just a blinking pixel. That's what it was. I mean, imagine for yourself a little black television screen with a lot of gray fuzz, and there in the very center of it, through the sonogram, I am seeing a single blinking pixel on the screen, and the technician says, that's the heartbeat. That is your baby's heart beating. I couldn't see a head, I couldn't see a tail, I couldn't see arms or legs, eyes, ears, none of it. I was overwhelmed, and I could hear this heartbeat. And I thought to myself, there's a little person in there. I said to my wife, I remember afterwards, we were driving home from the hospital, doesn't it kind of make you feel queasy to think you got a little person swimming around in there? And she said, where have you been the last 6 weeks when I've been throwing up every morning? Oh, and I remember the second sonogram and the third. We got three in that first pregnancy. And every one of them became clearer. Now, with the first one, I took the sonogram home and showed it to people. I even actually made a little card from a Xerox image of the sonogram, the clearest one that we had, and I sent it out to all my relatives. I'm kind of stupid this way. With a little balloon coming up from the mouth saying something. I can't remember what the baby was saying. Singing some sort of a song. I had a little chicken or something like that. I don't know what it was. You know that song, I had a little chicken but it wouldn't lay an egg? Do you know that one? Maybe this is just tech. I had a little chicken but it wouldn't lay an egg, so I poured hot water up and down its leg. The little chicken cried, and the little chicken begged, and the little chicken laid a hard-boiled egg. My dad used to sing this song to me. It must be a Texas thing. Okay, so I send out a card with the little... It was almost like one of these portraits that is a cutout of a profile. What do they call those things? They used to do them in the old days. Silhouette. It was just a silhouette of this child. In the old sonogram technology. And I sent it out with the little balloon singing the little song, and everyone got a big kick out of it. The third one was unbelievable. The kid wouldn't stop moving. And so we didn't get any real clear images. Here's a spine, here's a leg, there's a foot. Now with the second kid, we got videotape. They had upgraded the sonogram machine so you could actually slide a tape in. They could hit the record button, and you could get real-time video of the sonogram, the whole procedure, all the way from the blinking pixel up to the little squirming baby in there that wouldn't hold still. And I remember the technician would, like, poke on my wife's stomach, and the baby would do a little backflip or a little whoa kind of a gesture, like, what's going on? It was overwhelming to see these things. I showed that videotape to everybody who would look at it. And half the people who were watching it were like, well, I can't really make anything out. That now we have these images. Have you seen these, folks? These images where it's unmistakably a baby. It's a 3D image. All the way from the size of a grape. And I'll admit, that's hard to make out. I don't know exactly what that's all about. All through the months of pregnancy. And here is this last one at week 35 that I just find unbelievable. This looks for all intents and purposes like any baby you'd see sleeping in any crib. And there's a reason for that. You want to know what it is? It's because it is a baby sleeping in a crib. The crib is the woman's womb. There's no difference. The little baby that's sleeping there in the womb will, in a couple of weeks or days after that sonogram is taken, be sleeping in a crib. Are we amazed that it looks the same? We shouldn't, because it's exactly the same person. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Or perhaps you were moved by the other image, and Scott mentioned this one. It was the image of that little hand reaching out of this uterus that had been extracted from the woman's body. They're doing fetal surgery. In utero surgery. And this little hand reaches out, tiny, tiny little hand reaches out and grabs the index finger of the doctor who's doing the surgery. Unbelievable. At my home church, there was a doctor there. He was oh my goodness, I imagine a doctor who does this gets paid a lot. He was a neonatal heart surgeon. That was his specialty. He did surgery on newborn and premature babies when they had heart trouble. Open heart surgery. Now apparently he has to wear some sort of binoculars on the front of his, they're not binoculars, they're microscopes, on the front of his glasses that strap to his head so he can see what he's doing. And he uses instruments that are like little baby instruments. They're not the big scalpel that you see in the movies or in the television shows. He uses these tiny, tiny, tiny little instruments that look like Barbie instruments to do open heart surgery on newborn babies and premature babies. Now, when he opens up that little baby to fix the heart, what does he find in there? He finds a human heart. It's very small. That heart may be the size of a walnut. Yours is about the size of your fist, but it's a human heart. He finds real blood pumping around in that body. He finds a little baby that if he fixes what's wrong with the heart, this little baby will grow up. Now, we're amazed at the difference of size. He's got little bitty scalpels and little bitty forceps and little bitty retractors and little bitty everything, and he's doing it through two huge microscopes attached to the front of his head. But what is he doing? He's just doing surgery on a human being who just so happens to be very small. I think it should say something to us. He doesn't use anything, any other different techniques. The heart doesn't pump differently. The basic procedures of the surgery are no different. Why should they be? He's operating on a human being. Now, I think I sincerely trust this doctor I'm talking about was pro-life, but I don't see how any doctor could do that and not look upon this little miracle of a life and conclude that 3 months earlier, when it was lying asleep in the mother's womb or kicking around, it wasn't the same little person that it is on his operating table. Or later, when he gets to see this little baby grow up to be a toddler and run around and enjoy life because he was able to save its life. You know, there are those who would say that a doctor like that, who does open heart surgery on little newborn or premature babies, there are those who would say, now they wouldn't come out and say it, but they will argue in another form, that he is wasting his time. I mean, after all, a little baby born with a heart that hasn't completely formed correctly, or where the blood supply hasn't differentiated to the two sides of the heart, where the blood supply is still mixing, the baby can't get enough oxygen. By the pro-choice argument, why do surgery on a baby like that? That baby's not viable. Viable means able to survive on its own, as much as a baby can, outside the womb. By the deadly logic of the pro-choice argument, that little baby should be left to die. And it's not a person, because it's not viable. Did you read the Newsweek article, the one philosopher? She says, we've got to consider two things. One, whether or not the mother wants the baby, and number two, whether or not the baby is viable. By her logic, a very cold and deadly logic, the baby that is born with a heart that doesn't work right is not viable. And if the mother should say, I was really hoping for a baby with a heart that worked right, I'm kind of disappointed. You know, you can't send the baby back. But by her logic, this little child, born as it is, doesn't deserve to live either. If the mother doesn't want it, I mean, that's two strikes. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Here's a headline. The Associated Press is reporting that the U.S. wants the court out of a very famous abortion case. Washington, this week, the Bush administration urged the Supreme Court to reject a politically charged abortion case that seeks free speech protection for protesters who use wanted posters to target doctors. The White House said that the court should leave undisturbed a ruling against anti-abortion protesters for listing personal information about abortion clinic employees on their internet sites and on posters. Now, you've heard about this before. There was a website that was called the Nuremberg Files. It's not up anymore. Where information and images of abortion doctors and personnel were listed in the form of wanted posters on the website. The Supreme Court asked for the government's view in the case in December, and it delayed action on the appeal by activists who were ordered to pay nearly $110 million in punitive damages. The administration's brief was filed Friday and made public Monday this week. The justices probably will decide this month whether to hear the case, which involves a law that protects access to abortion clinics. Justices often, but not always, follow the recommendations of the government. So they asked the Bush administration, a pro-life administration, what should we do? We are going to possibly hear an appeal from some pro-life activists who do not feel that they should have to pay $110 million in punitive damages awarded by a lower court because they put the images and the information of abortion doctors on their website, and three of those doctors later were killed. They don't think they should have to pay that. The Bush administration looks the thing over and says, justices, we suggest that you simply refuse to hear the case. Which is, in effect, the Bush administration saying, let's stand the lower court's decision and let these pro-life activists pay $110 million. I mean, after all, if the Supreme Court shuts the door on you, the door is shut. And you pay the $110 million. What do you think about this? I mean, this is a pro-life administration. There's no doubt about it. And the Supreme Court has sought the Bush administration's advice. Should we hear this case? What do you think? Does it merit? Have you look it over too? Do you think it merits an appeal that we should hear? Or should we let the lower court's ruling stand against these pro-life demonstrators? The Bush administration says, don't hear it. Does that disappoint you if you're pro-life? After three doctors listed in the Old West-style wanted posters on this website were killed in the 1990s, other physicians sued, claiming that they feared for their lives after being included in a round of posters. Anti-abortion activists were accused of violating a racketeering law and the 1994 Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. The activists maintained that their activities are protected free speech. Their attorney, Edward White III, said he was disappointed that the Bush administration opposed the appeal. We think that the United States of America should support free speech for all groups, he said. What about you? Is the Bush administration squelching the free speech of these abortion activists, anti-abortion activists, by urging the Supreme Court not to hear their appeal and let stand a $110 million punitive damage case leveled against them? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. In the next hour, Bob Leiko will join us, but not until we've had 25 more minutes of open lines. Tomorrow on the program, by the way, for those of you who may have missed or who are missing the conversation that we were going to have with Phil Lacus, there will be a two-hour discussion on Christian ethics in the workplace. Ray Hilgert, Jim Truesdale, and Pastor Phil Lacus, co-authors of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, called Christian Ethics in the Workplace, will join us. And also tomorrow, a legal, political, cultural, and theological perspective on the subject we're discussing right now, and that's abortion. Ed Meese, Robert Bork, Senator Rick Santorum, Senator Sam Brownback, Sarah Foster, Father Richard John Newhouse, Cal Thomas, and Dr. James Lamb will all contribute to that hour of Issues, Etc. tomorrow. When we come back from this break, we'll take your phone calls at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you believe that the Bush administration should at least allow these pro-life activists who have been ruled against by the lower courts to appeal one more time to the Supreme Court and see if they can't get lifted this $110 million punitive damages that have been awarded the other side in their case? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Is the Bush administration, well, are they being loyal to the pro-life cause?
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What should a Christian do when he finds out about mismanagement of funds at work? How should you deal with a supervisor who always takes credit for your work? Find out with the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Christian Ethics in the Workplace is written by a theologian, an executive, and a business school professor. In this book, you'll find out how to prevent corporate scandals like Enron, Global Crossing, and WorldCom. The cost is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Christian Ethics in the Workplace, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June. For more information, Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The already dark world of internet pornography appears even darker to many after news reports detailing the tie between the smut and organized crime. Terry Phillips reports.
The structure is like a funnel, with small-time pornographers routing clients and money to big-time crime. Jan LaRue is chief counsel of Concerned Women for America. She says best estimates point to at least 100,000 porn sites.
And when, you know, you reduce them down, it appears that they're run by about 20 to 30 very large companies, and, you know, you can easily find ties to organized crime.
According to Glenn Fradenberg of Be Safe Online Incorporated, the income dwarfs many legitimate industries.
I think people feel pretty confident. It's $10 billion spent annually on porn. That is larger than the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball all combined.
$10 billion is conservative. It may be three times that.
Yes, that's just in this country. It's been estimated at $56 billion worldwide.
The World Wide Web is the perfect delivery vehicle, providing the perfect snare.
The industry itself is out to make certain that if you are on the internet unprotected, they are going to every length to make sure you're exposed to it.
Trace the tendrils, and almost all sites lead into the criminal underworld.
Anybody in law enforcement that's worked on this area will tell you that you don't have any business in pornography without the permission of the mob.
Reason enough to protect your computer and your family. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
The porn industry has lots of money to throw at bypassing filtering software. It hires the best technical experts to go to work on circumventing the newest filters. Two of the most family-friendly screening programs come from Be Safe Online and ChristianNet. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On Friday's Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Kay Marshall Strom, who, with her husband Dan Klein, co-authored The Savvy Couple's Guide to Marrying After 35. And we'll also talk with Bill Parsons about cholesterol control without diet. It begins at 11:05. Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
In today's fast-paced business world, where compromise is easy, where can we turn for practical and moral guidance? Find out with a book, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Christian Ethics in the Workplace is the Issues Etc. book of the month for June, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, our Issues Etc. book of the month for June.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's open lines. We'll get to your phone calls here in just a second. I would like to do a couple things here before we go to the phones. First of all, we will be talking with Douglas Johnson, Legislative Director of National Right to Life, in about 10 minutes up to the remainder of the hour. We'll be talking to him about the partial birth abortion ban of 2003 that passed yesterday. We'll find out what the ban bans and what its prospects are in conference committee, because the Senate has passed a similar bill, and to the president's desk and beyond, whether or not there will be any judicial challenges to the partial birth abortion ban. How big of a deal is this? Douglas Johnson joins us here in about 10 minutes. First, let's take your phone calls, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with John, who's calling from Baldwin. John, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, Pastor Todd. I support Bush's administration and its decision, well, and its recommendation to the Supreme Court to refuse to hear the case regarding those websites. What was the name of the websites?
One of them was called the Nuremberg Files.
Yeah. Yeah, I support the Bush's administration's recommendation on that.
So you feel like those pro-life activists did violate the law and they ought to be paying that $110 million in punitive damages?
I believe they should be paying punitive damages. Now, whether $110 million, I do not know, but what they did was unnecessary, and any reasonable person would know that by putting on those websites, such actions were more than likely to happen.
John, thank you very much for the call. You know, I heard one person liken it to, you know, you put these, the internet is open and accessible to all, to the sane and the insane, to the violent and the pacifist, and you put the doctor's image and his information, his address and those kind of things up there on a wanted poster, and it is tantamount to yelling fire in a crowded theater. You are inciting danger for those people. What do the rest of you think about it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ty is calling from his car. Ty, welcome to Issues Etc.
How are you doing today?
Doing well.
You were talking earlier, Todd, about the Freudian slip, as you called it, with the woman using the term mother.
Ellen Goodman, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you may have discussed this on the show before, but have you heard the Planned Parenthood ad on the radio that's got Sarah McLachlan on it? She's the pop singer.
I don't think I have.
She's been she's doing a piece of spot for Planned Parenthood. Obviously, very much pro-abortion. But in the background of her commercial, they're playing her most well-known song, which is "I Will Remember You." So it's going on the whole time, and in a very, very sick and twisted sort of way. I always chuckled when I heard it. I'm like, well, thank you very much. Because if anyone could actually hear this song, this haunting melody singing "I Will Remember You" in the background, there's no possible way they can hear that and not think, wow, this is just not a very good choice to be playing in the background for someone encouraging girls to come in and get an abortion.
You know, I tend to take a very cynical view of things like this, and I probably shouldn't, but I think there's an attempt here. And now that you mention it, I have seen the ad. I just didn't put two and two together.
It's a radio spot that I heard.
Yeah, I think that what the attempt here is to appease the conscience beforehand. And that is, look, we know you're going to have to kill your baby. I mean, this is the basic message, to put it in simple black and white. We know you're going to have to kill your baby because you're too young, you're too stupid, you're too uneducated. It will ruin your life, yada, 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 all the arguments that are being put forth. But you can appease your conscience by promising right now to remember the baby that you will kill. And then
right.
You'll feel better about it. You know,
apparently, though, the song has disappeared from the spot. Now it's just got the voiceover, and the song is not there anymore. I haven't heard anything about it, but it's been conspicuously missing the last few times I've heard it on pop radio stations.
Maybe they realized the inconsistency. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Ty, thank you very much for
thank
the call.
You.
You know, the reason I say that is not just because of one isolated radio spot. The reason I say that is because there has been an attempt, and I think it's more recent than, I think it's more recent. There has been an attempt by the pro-choice community to try and tug at the heartstrings. And they're doing it, in full knowledge of the fact that women find abortion a difficult decision to make. And I think they're playing to the sentiment. Now, ultimately, the real argument that the pro-choice community uses is fear. I just laid out the fear-mongering that goes on. And there's no other way to call it anything but fear-mongering. You're too young. You don't have enough education. That career that you'd hope to have, you won't have because of this baby. Their whole future laid ahead of them is laid out as one series of failures and disasters because why should your whole life be ruined? Because you just made one bad choice. You got pregnant, okay? No big deal. But why should you allow that to ruin your whole life? That's the fear that is being sold young women, and women who are older too. That's the fear that's being sold their mothers too, because their mothers are apparently talking them into this, and the boyfriend and everyone else. But it is all couched in dripping sentiment. There is a NARAL commercial, shows little girls playing in a playground, swinging on swings, the cutest little girls you've ever wanted to see. And they're talking about how much potential and how much future this little girl has. You know, what they're encouraging, to advertising is not rocket science. What they're encouraging the young woman who's considering an abortion to do is to picture herself as this little girl. I once was so bright with potential. I once had such a future ahead of me. I was once carefree. I was once this little child. And now, because I've made this one mistake, I got pregnant. Everything I hope for as a little girl, all my dreams and aspirations, are in danger of being destroyed by this baby in my womb. That's the message. It's really very simple. But it's woven together with sentimental music and nostalgia for one's childhood. And when you're done watching the commercial, the young woman who's considering abortion has got to be thinking to herself, well, how could I not abort this child? Why would I want to throw my whole life away? And lost in the shuffle, of course, is the fact that this little girl being shown playing on the playground wouldn't even be there had her mother not decided to have her. In fact, the playground would be empty if every mother decided to do what the commercial was encouraging young women to do. We wouldn't have playgrounds anymore. We wouldn't need them. Why would we need them? We wouldn't have any children to mess up our lives if if everyone did what the commercial was urging young women to do. I asked the question once, and this is, I think, a crucial question for pro-lifers, because I think we've conceded ground where we need not concede ground. I've asked the question once, and this is not the be-all and end-all of abortion or anti-abortion arguments. It's just one question among many. Do you really believe that the woman is better off having the baby? Is a woman always better off having her baby? You know, there are pro-lifers who would hesitate to answer that question and say, yes, always better off. You might say, well, okay, look, they may not be better off, but the baby will live and therefore everything will come out well in the end. No, I'm asking the question, is the mother always better off having her baby? I think that pro-lifers ought to get used to answering that question in the affirmative. Yes. It's better for everybody. It's not just better for the baby that the baby live. It's better for the mother, too. Doesn't mean she might miss a career opportunity that she would normally have had she had the abortion. Maybe. But she will be better off. Now, arguing for the woman's well-being is one of the trickiest arguments in the pro-life arsenal. It really is, because, of course, one might be able to argue in some extreme case that a woman wouldn't be better off. I don't believe it's true, but you might be able to do that. We better get used to answering that question in the affirmative, and I'll tell you why. Because that is the argument being made by the pro-choice community to that young lady who's thinking about having an abortion. The argument is, you will not be better off. There is no way in God's green earth you will be better off if you have this baby. Your only way out, your only escape from a future of darkness and misery and despair and poverty and who knows what else, is to make this hard choice and have an abortion. We better get used to answering the question, is a woman always better off? Yes. Yes. Let's go back to the phones real quickly. Jim is calling from his car. Jim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask you, obviously, abortion on demand is a moral evil, and I think you're also aware that all moral evil has its continuing consequences, like a snowball going down a hill. It's my opinion that one of the reasons that Social Security will eventually fail in this country is because you are killing people who would eventually pay into the system. They're telling us that by about 2025, Social Security won't even be solvent anymore. It'll be a thing of the past. And I think part of the reason is that to date you've killed 43 or 44 million people who would be taxpayers, and obviously I think of human beings as more than taxpayers, but it's an interesting point, at least, to see what the spider web is here. In other words, the continuing consequences that go out into every area of the culture, not just the fact that it's a moral evil.
Jim, that's an excellent observation. Thank you very much for making it. And it's one that's been made before here on Issues, Etc., and that is simply a numbers thing. If abortion continues apace with its 30-year record, what will we be looking at by way of, I mean, we're talking about 40 million Americans. That's just Americans who haven't seen the light of day in the last 30 years. That's a lot of people. Now think about this. The little baby girl that was aborted in 1974, how old would she be today? She'd be 29 years old. She'd be having a baby of her own. So you got to add in another generation there too. Oh, our population would be bigger, but as the caller pointed out, we'd also have more taxpayers and more people working towards Social Security. The baby boom generation that glutted the system with 78 million babies back then, had there been abortion, that generation wouldn't have existed. It wouldn't have been 78 million. It would have been the normal numbers. Why do we call it the baby boom? Because there's been nothing like it since. Could there be with legalized abortion? I don't think so. I don't think we'll ever have another baby boom. Because we found a way to keep the population low. Joining us for the remainder of this hour, Douglas Johnson. He's Legislative Director for National Right to Life. We're going to be talking about the partial birth abortion ban of 2003. One very good piece of news to come out of the House yesterday. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Doug, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
It's good to be with you.
Tell us about this bill, H.R. 760, that passed yesterday.
Well, this is the bill to ban partial birth abortions nationwide that we at National Right to Life have been working for 8 years now to get enacted. And I'm sure everybody remembers that twice it went to President Clinton, twice he vetoed it. Twice the House overrode the vetoes, and in each case we were not able to quite get up to the two-thirds to override in the Senate. But now we don't need two-thirds anymore because we have a President, George W. Bush, who's eager to sign this bill. The Senate's already passed it back in March, and the House passed it yesterday in a slightly different form, and they did have a two-thirds margin.
What exactly does the bill itself prohibit?
Prohibits any abortion in which the baby is delivered while still alive to the point where, if feet first, the baby is past the navel, literally past the belly button outside the body of the mother. And you might say, well, that's an awfully weird thing to write into a bill, but the fact is the earlier version that wasn't that specific that Nebraska enacted, the five Supreme Court justices said they weren't quite sure what it applied to. So Congress has made it all the more explicit. They've done everything but literally draw a picture of a partial birth abortion in the bill, which isn't allowed. So they've explained it very clearly. If the baby is delivered feet first while still alive to the point where at least the navel is outside the body of the mother, then that's a partial birth abortion. Or if it were ever done head first, it says if the head is all the way outside of the mother, then that would be a partial birth abortion too. Now, this is done. It's done thousands of times a year, this feet-first delivery. And it's been conceded by the abortion industry that in the vast majority of these cases, these are in healthy mothers of healthy babies, usually in the fifth and sixth month, sometimes even later. There's congressional testimony, which is cited in this bill, that this would be excruciatingly painful for the baby by this stage of development. 70% of the public in the Gallup poll in January says that this should be banned. So it's long overdue, and we're heartened that this bill soon will be going to President Bush for a signature.
Now, how many states at present have bans on this procedure apart from federal legislation?
Well, there are about 26 or 27 that passed bans that were effectively worded back in the late 90s mostly, but these bans are not currently being enforced because in the year 2000, the Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote, said that Nebraska's law could not be enforced. They said that, basically what they said, the five justices, is that Roe versus Wade guarantees the right of an abortionist to do this partial birth abortion procedure whenever he sees fit, whenever he thinks that it's the best way to do an abortion in the 5th and 6th month of pregnancy. So that is a problem. We hope that by the time this federal bill gets back up before the Supreme Court, that we'll have at least five justices there who are prepared to abandon that extreme position. But as of the year 2000, the last time they spoke to the issue, it was 5-4 in favor of partial birth abortion on the U.S. Supreme Court.
By making the language of the bill more specific and by describing the procedure in greater detail, do you think that will make a difference if the Supreme Court is comprised similarly as it is to today when this bill, it's not an if, it's a when this bill reaches the Supreme Court again?
Well, you see, they had two different problems with the Nebraska law and by implication with the laws the other states had passed because they were all similar. The ones I'm talking about were similar anyway. And one was the definitional problem where they saw a problem. They weren't quite sure whether the definition of partial birth abortion might also be applied to some procedures in which the baby is literally torn limb from limb while still inside the mother, what's called a D&E, where they literally the abortionist reaches into the womb with instruments and pulls off pieces, arms and legs and so forth, until the baby bleeds to death and finally removes all of the pieces. Now, that's a grisly procedure, but it does not involve mostly delivering a living baby, and this bill was not intended to address that procedure. But the Supreme Court thought that abortionists might be confused. So this new federal bill does address that with this more explicit definition about exactly how much of the baby has to be delivered and so forth. But the other problem is a bigger problem, which is the problem that the five justices really think it still has to be up to the abortionist whether he wants to do this method that does involve mostly delivering the live baby in the 5th or 6th month before plunging a surgical scissors through the base of the baby's skull and removing the brain with a suction tube. They said if that's the way he thinks it's the best to do it, that would have the least risk of side effects, even though most other physicians wouldn't agree, even though most other abortionists wouldn't agree, well, then you have to allow him to do that. To respond to that, the Congress has just put into this bill pages and pages of findings, so declarations based on congressional hearings that this is never necessary. It's not necessary to protect a woman's health or her life, although the bill would allow it to be done if it were ever necessary to save a woman's life. That would never be the case. So the Congress is laying before the court facts that the Congress has developed through these extensive hearings over a period of 8 years. And we can't predict what the court will do. We just hope that by the time it gets there, at least five justices, one more than we had before, at least five justices will agree to back off of that extreme position. You know, sometimes people change their minds. Sometimes people come and go on the court. It's going to take a while for it to get back there. We hope that they will back away from the position they took.
As far as conference committee goes, do you have any concerns about the Senate and the House being able to come to an agreement on a final bill to put on the president's desk?
You know, we have little concern about that. The two bills are basically identical, except the Senate tacked on this Harkin Amendment, which is a kind of a resolution endorsing Roe versus Wade. That passed with just 52 votes in the Senate, so it barely passed, but it does not have any legal effect, but it is an obnoxious thing, and obviously we would not want it to be part of the final bill. But this conference committee will be chaired by pro-life lawmakers on both sides, and we expect that they will take that thing and snip it out and throw it in the wastebasket before sending the bill to the president. But it does have to then be approved one more time by the House and Senate, so this could take, you know, a few weeks.
Is that Harkin Amendment intended to make this bill onerous to pro-lifers?
Well, I don't know if he had that in his mind. I think he was interested in getting senators to vote their positions on Roe versus Wade and declare them, and so that was of some interest. I mean, obviously, we've put that vote in our scorecards because it is instructive about senators' positions on the broader issue of Roe versus Wade. So this is a it is a landmark. This is the first time that the Congress is actually stepping in and saying, this has gone too far. We're going to start addressing the specifics here of abortion. I mean, they've dealt with things like federal funding of abortion. They've dealt with federal involvement and so in a variety of ways over the years since Roe versus Wade. But here they are actually looking at a specific method of abortion and saying, this is so brutal. This is something, now that we're confronted with it and have to say yes or no to it, that we won't tolerate. We can only hope that, as I say, that five justices on the Supreme Court will come to the same conclusion. In the meantime, we've got plenty of other things to keep us busy in the Congress, particularly the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, which we're hopeful the Senate will take up for the first time ever within a matter of weeks, I mean this summer. This is the bill, of course, that would recognize unborn children as victims when they are injured or killed in the course of crimes, violent crimes. Enormous public attention has been focused on that issue recently by the case of Lacey Peterson and her unborn son, Connor, their murders in California. The fact that the California authorities have filed two homicide charges in that case has really made a lot of people understand what the argument is about there, what the issue is. And we're very encouraged by these polls that have come out in the last couple of weeks, particularly the Newsweek poll this week, that found nationwide 84% of the public does believe that a double homicide charge is appropriate in this type of case.
One last question with only 30 seconds to answer here, Doug. If the future Supreme Court challenge is taken up and the Supreme Court does knock this down, God forbid, would that basically put everyone back on the drawing board for a ban against partial birth abortion, including the states?
If the Supreme Court struck the law down?
Yes.
Well, we just have to assess that at the time. I mean, you're talking about at least a year in the future, and a lot can happen between now and then.
Doug Johnson, thank you very much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Douglas Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life. And if you'd like to visit National Right to Life on the web, very simple to do so. Go to their website, nrlc.org. nrlc.org. When we come back from this break, Bob Leko will join us. We're going to talk about a very cheery topic for the last live hour of Issues Etc. here this week: total depravity and original sin. You know the terms. What do they really mean? And do you really believe in total depravity and original sin? If you get these two wrong, what else will you get wrong in your beliefs? Bob Leko is co-founder of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit, and author of an article in the latest issue of the Truth Matters newsletter titled "The Total Depravity of Man." He'll be next, right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.